This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Dear Madam President, an open letter to the women who will run the world. Written and read by Jennifer Palmieri.
Introduction. Dear Madam President, chart your own path. Dear Madam President, I'm not even sure who you are. Are you, at this moment, sitting on Capitol Hill or in a state house? Are you a young teacher in Maryland, wondering if you should run for something? Are you a volunteer mentoring students on the west side of Chicago? Are you browsing through a bookstore in Atlanta, wholly unaware of what your future holds? I don't know if you're a Democrat or Republican or something else. I just know that you are out there somewhere, and you need this audiobook. I wasn't sure how to address you in this letter. Doesn't Madam suggest you are married? Are we still going to define women, the first woman president, no less, by relation to a man? I could go with a gender-neutral salutation of Dear President. It doesn't matter if you are a man or a woman, so long as you can do the job. Bullshit. It matters. And you are going to be different. You will bring an entirely new perspective to the office. You will expand our nation's comprehension of what it means to be a leader. In its best moments, your presidency will give us a more fully realized sense of leadership, one that combines the best qualities of women and men. There will be many challenges. World and congressional leaders will test you. America will judge you differently than it did your predecessors. People will scrutinize you, your ambitions, your choice of clothes. You are a unique individual, yet you will be expected to represent every woman. Be conscious of it, but keep a positive attitude. It doesn't mean everyone who doubts you is sexist. We inherited this world with all its flaws. We didn't create it. All of us are trying to adapt and grow. Given all the gains women have made in the last 100 years, having a woman president may not seem like that big of a deal. It is. Step back and look at it from the arc of human history. It is still a revolutionary concept for a woman to be in charge. All of our models for a person in power, and certainly for the American president, are based on men. Our founding documents, our theories of leadership and governing, were all written by men, for men. It is time we reimagine leadership roles for women and men both. You will do that for us. You will chart a new course. When I first joined Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, I had a grave misconception about the task before us. Simply put, I didn't think it mattered that Hillary Clinton was a woman. I just thought she was the best person for the job. I didn't see all the complexities inherent in the task of electing the first woman president. Worse, I didn't see the new possibilities having a woman in the Oval Office would open up. We actually set out to prove that it didn't matter that Hillary Clinton was a woman. And we did. We showed that this woman could do the job of president as it had been done by every man before her, reducing her to a female facsimile of the qualities we expect to see in a male president. But I now see that path robbed Hillary of something very valuable, some measure of her own humanity, some of the qualities that were unique to her, qualities we may not find in a male president, qualities you will bring to the Oval Office that will add a new dimension to what we imagine when we think of our nation's leader. Women of the baby boomer generation face these same constraints in all professions. There was no other blueprint to work from other than to show that a woman could do the job, as it had always been done, by a man. Follow our model, be tough, prove yourself by the standards we set. You weren't even supposed to look like a woman. Dress like a man's version of a woman. Our eyes can handle that. Think of how Patti Smith, Joan Jett, and Pat Benatar, women pioneers in rock music, presented themselves to the world. Leather, black blazers, denim. Our eyes accepted them as women tough enough to take on a role meant for a man. Woman with a guitar, woman with a gavel, woman with a podium, woman with an oval-shaped office, women with objects of power. It has taken time for our eyes to adjust to them. Depending on how you keep score, a woman already has won an election for president. Hillary did that. She showed that a woman can win, even when she plays by the rules of the game as established by men. And she won with half of her humanity tied behind her back. You won't have to do that. You will still have a harder time than you should on the campaign trail. Getting the job will be harder for you than actually doing the job. You'll be great at the job, by the way. But you will face easier terrain than the last woman did. This time, our eyes will be more accustomed to the sight of a woman standing behind the podium center stage at the convention. Our ears more attuned to a woman's raised voice projecting, not shouting, into the crowd. Our sensibilities adjusted to focus on what she will do with the job, not question why she wants it. So, no gender-neutral moniker for you. You shall be Madam President. Let's celebrate the fact that you are a woman. I have always thought that I could do any job a man can do just as well as him. Only recently have I come to realize that I don't want to. I want to do the job the best way I can do it, not the way he would. That's what this letter is about. How women can lead in a new way. How we can create a new model of leadership in our own image, not a man's. You're preparing to lead our nation. Whatever you do to ensure that your voice is heard or that your position prevails, you are doing it in the service of our country. You don't see it as attempting to aggrandize yourself or being pushy. You certainly aren't going to wait to be asked for your view. You are going to assert yourself. If you didn't, you wouldn't be doing your job. You wouldn't be giving the country its due. That's an approach all women should adopt. I build on lessons I learned from my own life, where I was able to see President Barack Obama bring a new empathy to the Oval Office. From watching women like Hillary, Elizabeth Edwards, and my sister Dana Drago refuse to be defeated, even when the world told them they had lost. From mentors along the way who taught me the value of my own voice. I will start with one hopeful lesson I learned on Thursday, November 10th, 2016, a day after the world learned the outcome of the 2016 American presidential elections. I walked out of our campaign headquarters that night, still dazed from our loss, and encountered a large group of school children waiting outside for the Hillary campaign staff in the Brooklyn night. They were carrying signs and had covered the sidewalks in front of the building with hopeful messages written in chalk. We all belong here. Rise up. Do the most good. I felt a glimmer of optimism. For the rest of their lives, these kids would remember the night their parents brought them to Hillary's headquarters to cheer on the staff. I remembered those kids 2 months later when millions of women across America in communities from Anchorage, Alaska to Washington, D.C., showed up to make their presence known and voices heard as part of the Women's March. Women of all persuasions found it to be an empowering moment. Beyond politics, there was a sense among women that we had plateaued and needed to chart a new path if we were to make the progress we wanted and deserved. It was the start of a new chapter in the American story, in which women decided that we were no longer following old rules and conventions. We were creating our own game and going to write and tell our own story. This audiobook is for you, our first Madam President, and for all the women in America from all walks of life and all professions who know they are ready to lead. Chapter 1, The Day After. When the unimaginable happens, imagine what else may be possible. I want to tell you what the day after felt like. It felt like a movie scene you would never see. The scene where you don't defuse the bomb just in time. The scene where the world explodes. It is 7 a.m. on Wednesday, November 9th. I wake up in my room at the Peninsula New York Hotel, having gone to sleep 2 hours before. What follows? Silence. A suffocating silence, like I have been hurled into a black hole, disconnected from the rest of the world. It doesn't even seem possible to me that I could still speak with the other campaign staff. I imagine that if I picked up my phone to call one of them, it wouldn't work. I imagine each of them also tumbling in space, in isolation, no gravity, no orientation. This much I can process. I feel fear, free-floating fear. It is not attached to anything specific yet, just fear. Also this, a yearning, not a hope, because I can feel no hope on this day, but a yearning that this new world America is entering won't be as bad as we predicted. And failure. We failed. It was on us to save America, and we let her blow up. I recall President Obama pointing at me in jest just 36 hours earlier as he left the Philadelphia rally on Monday night saying, "Do not mess this up." "We got it. We got it," I replied. A different universe, a different lifetime, one I desperately want to get back to, one in which I understood how the world operated, where certain things were set in stone. Oh, God. Springsteen sang about that in Philadelphia, too. He sang Long Walk Home. It assures us that the flag flying over the courthouse means certain things are set in stone. I no longer know that to be true. Nothing feels set in stone now. I decide to give hope a try. Maybe this isn't the end, I tell myself. Given how hard the rest of the campaign was, it would make sense that Hillary would not win outright on election night. Maybe this is just another near-death experience, a really scary one. Maybe we will win on recounts or fight it out in the Electoral College and win there. Right. Winning on November 8th would be too easy. This campaign is going to have to go all the way to December 19th and win in the Electoral College. Another 5 grueling weeks of campaigning in overtime. Then we'll look back on this bleak Wednesday when we got a glimpse of what life would be like in the dark parallel universe where Donald Trump actually won, and we'll laugh. Remember how unfathomably awful that Wednesday morning felt? I try to get myself to believe in that possibility. Later, I'll be able to put enough stock in the theory to act on it. I will push for recounts and to fight it out in the Electoral College. But I don't feel real hope. The new post-explosion world I find myself in may be surreal, but it seems permanent to me. I think of Hillary. Devastation. I think of her, and all I can feel is devastation. She will be the least surprised that this happened. She came into this race with some reluctance, more than anyone would have imagined. She felt unease throughout the campaign, and we all kept telling her it would be fine. And now she suffers this, infinitely worse than 2008. I don't feel like we failed her so much as kidded ourselves into thinking all that we faced was manageable. She could feel what was happening, all the forces seen and unseen, cosmic and earthly, that were lining up against her. As soon as these thoughts of Hillary enter my mind, I shunt them aside. I am in a new world, and I don't feel like I know how to process emotion yet. I think of my sister Dana. She's in Dallas on her path to passing. My other sisters are with her, Lisa, Beth, and our new sister Misty. Misty is Dana's best friend in Dallas and has become her committed caretaker. 4 nights before, while I was talking with Sarah Latham, who had been managing the campaign transition for us, on how we would staff the communications team, text messages from Beth came in saying she was sorry to have to tell me this. She knew it was really bad timing. But the doctor thought that Dana could die that weekend, and I needed to call her that night to say goodbye. I did. From Hillary's hold room backstage in Cleveland at the Beyoncé and Jay-Z concert. It wasn't the first time I had said goodbye to someone who wasn't long for this earth. I had done the same with Elizabeth Edwards in her bedroom in Chapel Hill 6 years prior. You have to shout to be heard. I shouted that I loved her, and I was proud to be her big little sister. Dana was older, but a little shorter, and always much thinner than me. Lisa, my second oldest sister, told me on Friday night that even though the doctors thought death was imminent, she bet Dana would make it to Election Day. I agreed. Now it's Wednesday morning, and she's still alive. For the last 4 days, I struggled to keep everything compartmentalized. Dana went in one compartment. Though those final days on the campaign trail were packed, I found time each day to duck into a church or go for a walk or find some moment to commune with her. The doctors recommended that. They said it aided her path. The other compartment held the campaign. There was plenty of anxiety in that part of my head, too. I woke up feeling terrible on Tuesday, Election Day, an overwhelming sense of unease. It's hard to separate what part of that pall was from Dana and what was caused by the end of the campaign. But I know that even if Dana had been healthy and happily buzzing about Dallas at that very moment, I would still have felt terrible that day. I also know the unease wasn't a premonition of the loss that was to come. Whatever I felt on November 8th was part of life in the old world. It has little bearing on this new one. My Election Day unease had two sources. One was the stress and anxiety I had fought to suppress for the whole campaign, demanding its due. The second was that as much as I wanted and desperately needed the campaign to end, it had given me a nearly all-consuming purpose, and I feared the void the end would create. The void that came at the end of the 2004 presidential campaign, which had consumed nearly 2 years of my life, was filled by a crushing depression it took me a year and a lot of hard work to emerge from. This time, I wasn't just coming off of 20 months of the most grueling, no, the most harrowing campaign on record. My time on the campaign trail was preceded by 3 years in the Obama White House, and I wasn't just facing the end of a campaign, but also the imminent death of my sister. The anxiety and unease I felt had been lurking for the last week. By Monday, they had won out. I couldn't enjoy Monday night at all, even with all the spectacular trappings of the Obamas, Springsteen, Jon Bon Jovi, Lady Gaga, and Obama and Clinton staff there to enjoy the final rallies. Enjoy this last night, I told myself. Isn't this what you have worked so hard for? The answer had to be, no, it is not. All of this was for Hillary, and I hoped she was able to enjoy it. I knew that whatever happened Tuesday night, and I fully imagined a celebration, was to be Hillary's painstakingly hard-earned glory. I knew I would find no value in it for me. I knew whatever satisfaction I was to derive from the effort I put into the campaign, I'd already experienced on Friday morning in Pittsburgh. When we landed in Pittsburgh, I was told we had a long motorcade ride from the airport to Heinz Field, where our event was. Excellent. 35 minutes of near solitude. Rockstar hairstylist Isabel Getz, rockstar makeup artist Barbara Lacey, and I headed to Staff Van 3. You have to be a real veteran of motorcades to understand the virtues of Staff Van 3. Isabel, Barbara, and I are such veterans. Staff Van 3 is never as crowded as the other two vans, and even though it is three cars behind Hillary, riders in Staff Van 3 are best positioned to catch up to her when the motorcade stops. Because what matters most in your ability to get where you need to be is the ability to get out of the van fast. It was just the three of us in the van. We each had our own row. I decided that on this final Friday of the campaign, I was due 35 minutes of uninterrupted time to listen to my favorite playlist of the moment, Staff Walk On. The Staff Walk On playlist was a concept Nick Merrill, our traveling press secretary, and I came up with one plane ride a couple weeks back. It consists of songs that typify the staff's experience on the trail. It has songs like Queens Under Pressure, Jason Isbell's 24 Frames, Tift Merritt's Engine to Turn, Springsteen's Take 'Em As They Come, and even the hopeful Amongst the Waves by Pearl Jam. It was a sparkling fall day and a beautiful drive alongside the Allegheny River into Pittsburgh. I looked out the window, ignored the emails and texts, replayed amongst the waves a few times in a row. I took the time to really savor those moments. I expected we would win and didn't yet know about Dana's decline. There were reasons to believe I would enjoy other moments of celebration. But I also knew that the moments in which you can feel joy at the end of a long, hard effort are fleeting, and I needed to take advantage of this one. The gratifying moment isn't likely to be the official moment of victory when your candidate wins. The gratifying moment is simply the one in which your own mind decides to let you believe you have done your best and your effort has mattered. That is my reward. Because what I have learned about myself is that while I welcome accolades and celebrations like anyone else, I don't derive a sense of accomplishment from them. That can only come from myself. So no, those moments on Monday night and what I hoped to see on election night weren't the ones I had worked so hard for. It was this one. Those moments in that van in Pittsburgh were to be the last sense of well-being I would have for many months. When I left the Obama White House to join the Clinton campaign as her communications director, I thought that Hillary would win, but I didn't think I would look to join the White House after the campaign. I had 12 years there already working for President Clinton and President Obama, and I figured I should take a break. In the closing days of the campaign, Hillary talked to me about coming to work at the White House if she won. We never landed on anything definitive, but I probably would have done it. I wouldn't have felt great about it, though. It would have felt like holding on to a crutch, like I was scared to face who I was without a White House title or a candidate attached to my name. And now I face a loss on Wednesday morning, the thing I didn't worry about, the thing I was not capable of worrying about because it was unimaginable to me. Intellectually, I knew it was possible to lose. Our own polling in the closing weeks showed a 1 in 4 and sometimes a 1 in 3 chance of that. But my gut and my heart saw the very fact that the campaign was so hard as some sort of karmic insurance that we would win. The harder it got, the surer I was that our effort to ward off a dangerous presidency would be rewarded. What seemed unimaginable to me was that we would put Hillary through so much hell, that we ourselves could endure such a grueling campaign only to lose to Donald Trump. That every moment we participated in during the campaign was a small part we were each playing in our role to make Donald Trump the next president of these United States. That's what I couldn't imagine would happen. And yet it did. So I entered this new world, where every day I live with having to watch someone be hurt because of the win we failed to secure, where the unimaginable happens every day. Sometimes in my new life, I will go to text someone and find that the last message I have from them is from election night. 2:43 a.m., Wednesday, November 9. "Hey, hope you are good. Has HRC called to concede?" It's always a jolt. It doesn't seem as if it should be possible for texts from an old universe to exist in today's world. Shouldn't they have been destroyed in the explosion? Evidently, there was to be some mercy in this new life I began that Wednesday, because despite what had been expected, Dana Drago was still in it. I had a feeling on that morning, which turned out to be true, that she wasn't going to die soon. She would not recover, of course. You don't recover from early onset Alzheimer's, not yet. But I no longer felt that I had to race to Dallas to say goodbye in person. I had planned to go on Thursday. I told my husband, Jim, Wednesday morning that I wanted to move my flight to Saturday. I felt like I had more time and I needed more time. Hillary loses, Dana persists. You never really know what's going to happen. There is so little within your control. But since we live in a world where the unimaginable is suddenly possible, we need to seize on that by imagining what else might be possible now that seemed unimaginable before. During the campaign, I spent a good part of my life on the Northeast Regional Amtrak line, going from New York to my home station in Baltimore. After a long break, I took the train again in the summer of 2017. The Northeast Regional has an unmistakable scent. If you take the regional, you know the scent I'm talking about. It hit me as soon as the doors to the train opened. It smelled like 2016. A pang of something close to homesickness washed over me. I sat down and thought for a while, trying to understand what it was that I actually missed. I was surprised to find that I really didn't want to go back to my pre-election life. I wasn't entirely comfortable in this new world, but I somehow felt more solid in it. I had survived the unimaginable. Another casualty of the explosion was my anxiety about what my value would be now that the campaign was over. It disappeared the night of November 8th and never came back. I'm embarrassed that it took this devastation for me to see what else was possible for me. Sitting there on the Amtrak, I found that even though we lost, the memory of my drive in Pittsburgh still gave me a sense of satisfaction. I did the very best I could in the campaign and put all my heart and soul into it. I kept faith with my candidate and fellow staff, and we stuck together through both the campaign and the brutal aftermath when critics who weren't there and didn't live through what we did sought to tear us down. I realized that after the trappings of the West Wing and campaigns and my own expectations of how life is supposed to go are stripped away, all I really need to have value is to put my very best effort into something that matters. I decided the pang of homesickness I felt was for the confidence I used to have that I knew how things will turn out. I miss my bearings. They were more central to my well-being than I had realized. I think a lot of women feel that way and initially viewed the uncertain post-November 9th world with unease. We had lived our lives playing by a certain set of rules, and they failed us. We didn't know what to make of it at first. Could it be that women are meant to go only so far in this world? No, that can't be it. Women haven't plateaued. It is the rules we are playing by that are outdated. We are learning to appreciate that with this uncertainty comes an empowering new sense of possibility. I look around at all that women are doing in America today, and I am inspired. Women aren't just running for office in record numbers, they are winning in record numbers too. In the worlds of art, politics, and business, women aren't following anyone's rules. They are creating their own game. So you see, Madam President, having survived that unprecedented scene in the movie where the world exploded after all, we can now write our own happy ending. From now on, we will decide what is possible for us. This movie ends with women running the world. Chapter 2. Move forward, draw fire. Brace yourself. Nothing draws fire like a woman moving forward. It's the afternoon of Wednesday, November 9th. We are at the New Yorker Hotel, and Hillary has just finished her concession speech. I decide to just nod and smile wistfully when supporters and reporters, men and women alike, laud it. Where was this Hillary during the campaign? They lament. Why didn't we see this side of her when it mattered? Yes, I'm sure you loved her concession speech, I thought. Because that's what you think is acceptable for a woman to do. Concede. Had I never left the Obama White House to be part of the campaign, I am sure I would have asked the same question. I probably would have printed out the transcript of her remarks and pored over them, trying to isolate the essence of what made this speech so much more appealing than anything she had said during the campaign. And I wouldn't have found it, because I needed to have the experience of working for a female presidential candidate to understand why we liked this Hillary so much better than candidate Hillary. Fundamentally, it wasn't about the words she used in her concession speech, but what she represented. She was no longer a woman pushing to be president. She was a gracious loser putting the needs of her country above her own. That is a role we are comfortable seeing a woman in, even if that woman is Hillary Clinton. It was the role of Hillary as an ambitious candidate that troubled us. We think a woman shines brightest when she is selflessly putting others' interests above her own. It is more flattering than seeking her own spotlight. I have to tell you that when I first joined Hillary's campaign, I didn't think it was going to be that hard or even that big of a deal to elect the first woman president. I thought it would be a tough campaign because Democrats were going for a third term, and there's all this stuff that seems to hang around Hillary that makes every endeavor she undertakes more difficult for her than it is for anyone else. But I didn't think electing the first woman was going to be that hard. We had already elected our first black president, and that seemed a more difficult thing to do in America. The way I saw it, women were advancing relatively well in the professional world. I knew I owed a debt of gratitude to the baby boomer women of Hillary's generation, who had been the ones to break barriers for women in so many professions. And I appreciated the rocky path they traveled that made the opportunities I had possible. I felt like women were on track now, and it would just be a matter of time until one became president. Suffice to say that after having gone through this campaign, I have a different view. I was wrong. And on two big counts. First, I didn't appreciate what a big deal it was from a historical perspective to elect a woman as president. And while in modern day America, it can feel as if most of us accept that women are equal to men, the women's rights movement is a relatively new phenomenon in our country. Consider this. Hillary Clinton's mother was born on the day Congress took final action to give women the right to vote. Not her great-grandmother, not her grandmother, her mother. That's how new this women in charge stuff is in the United States. Second, and this is the one I feel really bad about, I didn't see, as I do now, that all this stuff that hangs around Hillary stemmed from her being a woman. I didn't think the attacks and criticisms she suffered were fair, mind you. I just thought they were the result of 25 years of her and her husband being subjected to political attacks. It's what happens to politicians who survive for a long time. Your haters may not be able to kill you off, but the attacks are going to leave a mark, and they left a mark on Hillary. Of course, she did seem to draw even more ire than her husband. That should have been a clue. Before I delve into all that happened in the campaign, I want to be clear that while misogyny and sexism were a problem on the campaign trail, I don't believe that everyone who voted against Hillary did so for sexist reasons. If I don't make that clear at the outset, you might come away with the wrong lessons from the stories I have to share from 2016. Nor do I think the people who thought her concession speech was her best speech are sexist. I liked the concession speech too. But I do believe we encountered an unconscious but pervasive gender bias that held Hillary back in many ways. I think it's that subtle gender bias that made people find her so vexing. I think it comes from her being someone who pushed the boundaries of roles held by women for 40 years. Move forward, draw fire. That's a joke two of the Secret Service agents on Hillary's detail would say to each other when they would have to manage an internal bureaucratic disagreement. Guess we have only one option left, they would joke. Move forward, draw fire. It always made me laugh. I found it to be true on the campaign side of the operation, too. Yep. I would say, sometimes that's the only way. It's not an optimal political strategy. It would be better to just move forward. But it's rare in politics that an offensive move doesn't come with some collateral damage. You have to be comfortable with that. Women are particularly uneasy with drawing fire, which is too bad because nothing draws fire like a woman moving forward. In a sentence, I think that's what happened to Hillary and why so many people didn't like her or trust her. She has been moving forward and drawing fire for 40 years. Brace yourself, Madam President. You too will get quite a bit of incoming. Since Hillary Clinton first delivered her student commencement speech at Wellesley and landed on the cover of Life magazine as the female face of the baby boomer generation. She has been a generationally challenging figure. She was the lady lawyer, married to the governor, who hadn't taken her husband's name and made more money than he did. Next, she was the first major presidential candidate's wife who had her own career and didn't stay home to bake cookies. She was the first lady who worked in the West Wing and took on the touchiest of touchy political issues, health care. She was the first woman to run for Senate, run for president, become Secretary of State, and run for president again. She was constantly stepping outside the confines of the box in which women had always operated. She was always confounding us. Not because we all wanted to keep women in a small box, but because there was no model we could compare her to. She didn't make sense to us. Looking at all this through today's lens, none of what she did may seem revolutionary, but it sure made a lot of people uncomfortable in real time. 40 years later, there still isn't a model you can compare Hillary Clinton to, and many people still struggle to make sense of her. Even with all the gains women have made across the board, Hillary's life experiences are without parallel. I think that makes it hard for people to relate to her. And yet, most Americans did think Hillary Clinton could do the job of president. A majority of voters in 2016 were ready to accept a woman in charge, and that's important progress to be celebrated. The hurdle she never quite surmounted was having us all accept that it's okay for a woman to have the ambition to want to be in charge. It's that ambition part where Hillary ran into trouble. No male candidate has ever had to hide his ambition to get elected. After all, there are few goals more ambitious than becoming president of the United States. So despite her qualifications, Hillary's ambition made voters uneasy. Yet it wouldn't have been possible for her to run for office without it. The source of that unease is the same unconscious gender bias that inspired the disturbing refrain we heard throughout 2016. I am fine with a woman being president, just not this woman. If Hillary had won, I think people would have liked her as president. It would have been a difficult existence for her. She would have been hounded by a Republican-controlled Congress from day one. But she's used to that and would have dug in and figured out a way to get the job done. I believe her favorability rating would have risen in office, even though that was not the case with most of her predecessors. Typically, our presidents are most popular when they are candidates. Their popularity drops once they are in office and constrained by the duties of the job. But people seem to like female elected officials once they are in office. That's what happened to Hillary when she became a senator. Once she was in office, she was just doing the job voters gave her permission to do. That's no longer confounding. That's a woman fulfilling her responsibilities. We expect a woman will do a good job. When Hillary first started the 2016 campaign, she sought out the advice of women academics and researchers who have done a lot of work looking at the issue of women and ambition. After listening to them and others, our polling team advised us that Hillary's ambition needed to be expressed in terms of her having the ambition to be in service to others. Otherwise, her ambition to be president was off-putting to people. Our culture still tends to characterize ambitious women as pushy, conniving, and selfish. This is not unique to politics. It's true for women who have ambition, whether they're in politics, business, sports, or the arts. Hillary's ambition to be president could not be about her. She had to be in the race to help others. In service to others was a mantra constantly drilled into our heads. We would present her accomplishments as things she had done in service to others, and what she sought to do as president as being in service to others. Similarly, our polling showed that Hillary's most popular attribute with voters was that she had been willing to go to work for President Obama, the man she had lost to in 2008. See, her ambition really is about serving others. It was tough making people feel comfortable with Hillary's ambition, so I was grateful that we had hit upon an attribute of hers that voters embraced. Still, I found it disconcerting that people didn't appreciate the outstanding job she did as Secretary of State so much as they approved of her going to work for the man who had defeated her. She did want to be president to help people, so I didn't have a big problem with the in-service to others mantra. But it was a little disheartening. You may be surprised to hear that Hillary fully embraced in-service to others. I'm not sure she loved it, but she knew she wasn't going to change historic sensibilities about women's roles in the span of one campaign. She needed to meet voters where they were and was glad for the advice on how best to do it. Madam President, the fact that you have been elected means voters have moved a little farther down the road since the days of Hillary's campaign. But whatever resistance persists toward women seeking power, you will have an easier time pursuing your own ambitions because of the work Hillary did tilling that same soil. All women with big dreams and ambitions will. One thing our campaign was never able to move beyond was the vexing issue of Hillary's emails. I think it was that unease people felt about Hillary's motivations as a woman seeking power that made it impossible for us to ever fully put this matter to bed. I have weathered a lot of political crises, but never encountered one quite like this. It was a box we could never get out of. I found the summer of 2015, when we were really drowning in email stories, to be the most difficult time of the whole campaign. We were trying to decipher, and I use that word quite literally, what was really behind the uproar the email story caused and what we could do to move beyond it. The press's goalposts for the questions she needed to address were always moving. First, we had to establish that using personal email was legal. We established that. To this day, no one is satisfied with our answer. Next, the press says she needs to explain why she used a personal email account. She explained. It is not good enough. No, tell us why she really did it, they would say to me. Next, it was, she needs to admit it was a mistake. She says it was a mistake. That's not good enough either. After many painful conversations on the matter, we finally decided in late August 2015 that Hillary would do a series of interviews where she could answer more questions about emails, with the hope of putting the matter behind us as we headed into the fall. There was plenty of reason to doubt this plan would succeed. She had answered dozens of questions about emails before to no effect. At the beginning of Labor Day weekend, she did an interview with Andrea Mitchell for NBC News. Hillary said it had been a mistake to use a personal email account. Andrea then asked her if she thought she owed the American people an apology. An apology to the American people, I thought. For what? And all the hours of torturous discussions we had among ourselves, painstakingly going over every question that could possibly arise in any interview, the question of whether she needed to apologize had not occurred to us. Whatever harm had come from the emails, Hillary, and not the American people, bore the brunt of it. Thankfully, the American people weren't an injured party here. I didn't begrudge Andrea's asking of the question. It wasn't meant to be a gotcha. I think she meant it sincerely and was just doing a thorough interview. Still, my heart sank when I heard the question. I knew that once the issue of whether Hillary needed to apologize had been raised, we were never going to be able to move on until she did. The press coverage would obsess over when Clinton would apologize. It's day three. Where's the apology? After the Andrea interview, we all talked about how to deal with the apology question. Hillary was not happy about it, but she saw the same reality we all did. So she apologized in an interview with ABC's David Muir. It still wasn't enough. That's when it all became clear. They don't want her to apologize. They want her to confess to a crime she didn't commit. There's nothing she can say that will satisfy them. Madam President, I believe this to my very core. If it weren't her emails, it would have been something else. Another issue, equally trivial and irrelevant, for which Hillary would have been tortured. Because underneath all the questions about wiping servers and deleting emails lay the fundamental truth that what all of this was really about was that there was something about Hillary Clinton folks just didn't trust. And that something was an intelligent, capable, ambitious woman in a position of power. TSA HIJDL. Get to know it. Whether you are running for president or just a woman who challenges the status quo, there's something about her I just don't like. And it's sister complaint. There's something about her I just don't trust. It's what people said about her 25 years ago during her husband's 1992 presidential campaign. Before Travelgate, before Whitewater, before Hillary Care, before Benghazi, before emails. Madam President, look at all she encountered as a presidential candidate. All the gauntlets she had to run. From being the first presidential candidate ever called to testify before Congress, and earning the record for longest congressional testimony ever while doing it, to being the first candidate for the American presidency targeted by a foreign power. This was not the normal vetting process a presidential candidate goes through. Some larger force was at work here. Flying back from Florida on October 29, 2016, the day after the infamous Comey letter came out, I joked with Hillary about what seemed to be her ever-growing number of opponents. It felt like we had four men running against us: Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Julian Assange, and Jim Comey. I don't believe it is a coincidence that the first woman nominee of a major party ended up being hounded by four men, all taking actions that would influence the campaign in ways never before seen in our country's history. Maybe that's just how presidential campaigns are in the 21st century. Or maybe there was just something about her the four of them didn't like. Putin was no fan of President Obama, but he reserved a special ire for Hillary, the woman who dared to challenge the legitimacy of the 2011 Russian elections when she was Secretary of State. Julian Assange had long held animosity for her, too, going back to WikiLeaks' foray into the State Department cables when Hillary was Secretary of State. As for Jim Comey, when he sent that letter about additional emails to The Hill, he went out of his way to break precedent, despite claiming that his overriding imperative when it came to managing the Clinton email investigation was to follow standard FBI practice at all times. I know he doesn't see it that way, but obviously there was something about her case that drove him to ignore precedent and take an extraordinary step that may well have cost Hillary the election. As for Donald Trump, is it a coincidence that the first woman nominee of a major party lost a presidential election to a misogynist? I have my doubts. There were times in the closing weeks when the campaign felt less like a presidential run and more like a primal battle for survival. Between the accusations of sexual harassment and assault against Trump failing to dampen the enthusiasm of his supporters, the creepy locker-up rallies, Putin's Russian email leaks, Comey's letters, and Trump threatening that he might not accept the results of the election if Hillary actually won, it was a darkly surreal phase during which I literally had to pause every now and then to confirm that I wasn't dreaming. Earlier in the summer, Hillary, Senator Tim Kaine, his wife Ann Holton, and I laughed over the absurdities we encountered in the campaign, talking on our bus one morning in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I told them the campaign felt like a Batman movie version of a presidential campaign, Christopher Nolan style. Both candidates were from Gotham. Trump was our lead villain, but had help from side characters like Putin and Assange. We had other characters who, like Catwoman, were sometimes on our side, sometimes not. I put Comey in this category. President Obama was Commissioner Gordon, and the fate of the world hung in the balance. It was a funny comparison in July. In October, it almost felt too apt to be considered a metaphor. The trail was a scary place. Emotions were running so high in the country that I feared there was going to be some violence before the election. I even half-jokingly said to Hillary one day in October that it was beginning to feel like we were upsetting some cosmic natural balance by seeking to upend the patriarchy. I didn't really believe it, of course, but a large part of the country seemed to believe Hillary represented an existential threat to the proper order of things. I started this chapter by saying I hadn't expected the task of electing our first woman president to be as daunting as it was. I should tell you that Hillary did try to warn me. On March 23rd, 2015, my first day on the campaign staff, Hillary sat me and Deputy Communications Director Christina Shockey down and basically vomited up what it was like to have been her for the past 25 years. She wanted us to hear it all so we would have an inkling of what we were likely to encounter when representing her to the press and public. She held forth for more than an hour, starting with her husband's campaigns for governor, her belated decision to change her name to Clinton, the turmoil of White House years, ups and downs she had with the press, the times when the public seemed to really hate her, and the times the public liked her. What happened in each of her campaigns? She didn't have answers for why all this had happened to her, but she wanted us to be aware of it. I remember she told us that she was just a simple and serious person, and somewhat baffled that she provoked such rage from some quarters. I laughed at her description of herself as a simple and serious person, because she is also a warm and very reliable friend who is a lot of fun and brilliant. She is not just a simple and serious person, but I know what she means. She is simple in that she is direct. She doesn't have a lot of time for pretense. She is serious in that she really worries about the state of the world and wants to solve problems, not just look like she's trying to solve them. For all the grief Hillary gets about being inauthentic, the truth is that she is terrible at faking it. When someone asks her a question she thinks is stupid, it shows all over her face. You know the look I'm talking about. Other women politicians are much better at hiding their feelings when reacting to an idiotic or sexist question or a dumb idea from a colleague. Listening to simple and serious Hillary describe her experiences was a poignant moment. She was as bewildered as anyone by the phenomenon of Hillary Clinton. It seemed to me that she was as uneasy with some of the wild adulation of her as she was with the attacks, because neither reflects an understanding of the person she really is. A number of women I know and respect think it is a mistake to go back over everything that happened with Hillary in the 2016 campaign. Their view is that it's self-defeating for women to be seen as complaining about how Hillary was treated. I might share their view if I hadn't lived that campaign. We need to understand what happened. I think that's not just important to lay groundwork for your run, but to make the path easier for all women working to succeed in whatever role they choose. The unease we felt toward Hillary's ambition could hold any woman back. Madam President, none of us here today created this world where biases about women, particularly women in power, persist. We inherited it. Most of us, women and men alike, are trying to sort it all out. But there remains something that makes a lot of people uneasy about women trying to move forward. Even when you get to the White House, you will continue to draw fire, perhaps more than ever. That's why I wanted to describe to you the resistance we encountered the first time a woman tried to do this. I hope you draw less fire. But whatever happens, don't let anyone stop you from continuing to move forward. Chapter 3. In the Room. Speak up. Your voice is needed. I have been privileged to gain entry to some of the world's most powerful rooms. The Oval Office. The Prime Minister's study at Chequers in the UK. Number 10 Downing Street. The German Chancellor's office in Berlin. The Blue House in Seoul. The Imperial Palace in Tokyo. Even the Kremlin. I am indebted to the generation of women who came before me and fought to secure my place in those rooms. And when I am in them, I speak up on their behalf and on behalf of the women who have yet to gain access to them, because I don't want the privilege I have been given to go to waste. On your path, you will have had to fight to gain entry to the series of rooms that will lead you to the Oval Office. Even though it will have been a struggle, I hope you will know that you belong there and that it is your right and duty to speak your mind when you arrive. In the Clinton White House, I felt privileged to be allowed in the room. I had many generous mentors there, men and women both, who taught me I belong there and my voice mattered. I learned to speak up. It was in the Obama White House where I appreciated that it wasn't just my privilege, but my responsibility to speak in whatever room I was in. You aren't doing your job if you don't. I was offered the job of Deputy Communications Director for President Obama in the fall of 2011. I was thrilled at the prospect, but I felt some trepidation because I was going to be replacing a friend of mine, Jen Psaki, who not only was a unique talent, but had been with the president since early on in the 2008 campaign and was highly respected by him and all the senior staff. Both Dan Pfeiffer, the communications director, and David Plouf, President Obama's senior advisor, assured me that I could count on the same level of access and seniority afforded the other Gen P, that I would be treated as senior staff, that I would participate in all the meetings with the president, and so forth. I thought it was a good sign that they were saying all the right things, but I have to admit I didn't really believe them. As my friend and mentor Doug Sosnick, who was a senior advisor for President Clinton, best described it, the West Wing is a game of pickup basketball. Roles and positions matter some, but not a lot. What matters is your ability to gel with the other players and the gumption to get in the middle of the game. I was confident in my gumption, but not so sure about the gelling part. Around 10:30 a.m. on my first official day, Dan said, "Okay, let's go. We've got to go to the Oval for media prep." I thought, wow, these guys weren't bullshitting me. This wasn't going to be a job where I would sit in the outer office outside the Oval and make snide comments about the boys not letting me in the game and then second-guess the decisions they made in the room I wasn't allowed in. This was going to be a job where I was in the Oval and was expected to have the answers for the President of the United States. That's a whole different story. Here's how President Obama would handle first meetings with new staff. He was very welcoming, particularly when it was someone's first time in a meeting in the Oval Office with him, because he knew that was an incredibly intimidating situation. He was very kind and went out of his way to keep the stress level low and make you feel comfortable so you could do your job better. He was very aware of everyone in the room. At the end of a meeting, whether it be your first one or not, if you had not offered a view, he would most likely ask you specifically what you thought. Usually, the people who had not offered a view earlier in the meeting were women. He could tell if you were distracted, too. I was once in a large budget meeting in the Oval. I wasn't expected to present in this meeting, so I wasn't feeling like I was in the hot seat and therefore wasn't as engaged as I normally would be. I guess this was evident because at one point the president glanced over me and said, "Look at Jennifer. She is sitting there looking all stressed about some dumb Politico article that's getting ready to run and not going to matter when it does." And he was right. I was quite literally at that moment sitting there worrying about some dumb story Politico was doing. "Don't worry about it," he told me. "It's not going to matter." And he was right. In my first meeting with him, President Obama welcomed me, made me feel comfortable, and asked me what I thought. As my time there went on, I came to appreciate that he didn't ask people what they thought because he wanted to be nice, although he is, or because he wanted the women to feel included, although he did. He asked people what they thought because he wanted to know what they thought. One day, I was in a meeting with the president, and the staff members present were all women. This happened on more than one occasion. You can find the photos online. The president correctly assessed that one of my colleagues was holding back on sharing what she really thought, not believing it was her place to speak on a topic for which she was not directly responsible. "You're in the room. Speak up," he said to her, although I could tell he meant for each of us to heed his words. He was right. We all needed to hear it. "There is no other room." He gestured around at the curved walls of the office. "See? This is it. It's the Oval Office." He wanted us to make the most out of being in the Oval Office and all the power it represented, and he wanted to get the most out of us. Valerie Jarrett, a senior advisor to the president and someone who became my good friend and mentor, echoed his sentiments to me later. "The president isn't being nice when he asked your view. He needs it." None of us who were entrusted to be part of the president's senior staff were there just to do the job assigned to us. We were in the room because of the experience, perspective, and judgment we brought with us, and the President of the United States needed to hear from each of us. What's hard to accept in that moment is that you are that person whose views are worthy of being heard by the President of the United States. I was in my mid-20s when I started working in the Clinton White House. In all my 8 years of working with President Clinton, not one person was ever able to finish a sentence, including the president himself. Everyone was interrupted, and if you were scared to jump into an argument, you got left behind. I had no problem with that. I jumped right in. In some ways, I was more fearless in the Clinton White House than in the Obama White House. Under Clinton, I was happy to be the assertive younger woman mouthing off with my views. I wasn't necessarily